Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. The Mountain Life is a weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general, and even about Yetis. As a matter of fact, today in the program, we'll talk with Mike Kilchenstein of Ramp Sports about the unveiling of the Yeti. And I'm just going to leave it at that because he's going to tell us all about what a Yeti is, and it's all just in time for snow. And then we'll talk with the world's strongest librarian, Josh Hanagarney. We talked to him back in May, right when his book came out, but it was such a fantastic interview, and I know his book has been going wild, and he's spoken in many places around the Salt Lake Valley and Park City. He's a librarian at the Salt Lake City Library. We'll re-air that interview.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm Tim Henney. Then a conversation with Cindy McGill, dream interpreter who makes a living interpreting dreams around the world at events and places like the Olympics, Sundance Film Festival, and Burning Man. Cindy was also featured in Dreams, a documentary which chronicles live dream interpretation encounters that took place here in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival.
And knowing that we were going to speak with Cindy, I had a great little dream last
Excellent.
Night that I'm going to ask her about. I think it may be a little too personal. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm John Wells. Join Lynn and I Thursday morning for Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a fun and understandable way. We'll be talking with James Fallon, who's written The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. And then Brian Hare, who has written The Genius of Dogs, how dogs are smarter than you think. Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, this is Mayor Dana Williams. On November 8th, our community will come together for 24 hours of giving at livepcgivepc.org. There aren't any of us that aren't touched at least several times a year by the various nonprofits in town, so this is your opportunity to support them, and I appreciate it.
Presented by Park City Community Foundation, Summit County's Community Foundation, a nonprofit organization.
This is Cindy with KPCW Radio. On Friday, November 8th, Summit County will come together with one purpose, to help fund our area nonprofit organizations. KPCW supports all area nonprofits. Did you know that KPCW provides nearly $500,000 annually in free public service announcements to the nonprofit community? Could we charge for this? Sure, but we're KPCW. Please consider donating to KPCW to fund our open door policy on November 8th. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, for centuries, tales of the Yeti, an elusive but terrifying creature said to roam the inhospitable Himalayan mountains, have enthralled curious minds. And now, while the mystery hasn't exactly been solved, the Yeti, still terrifying but not so elusive anymore, because he's hanging out outside Ramp Sports right here in Park City, all 30 feet of him. And here to tell us about the lore and the myth of the Yeti, and also about the unveiling coming up this weekend, is president of Ramp Sports, Mike Kilchenstein. And it's nice to have you here. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Lynn. Thank you.
And before we get going into the Yeti, we have to talk about a significant crash on Interstate 80 eastbound. It's right below Lamb's Canyon, and traffic is backed up below the mouth of the canyon. That's a long way.
Yeah, Lamb's Canyon all the way out to the mouth of Parley's. That's a big one.
That is a big one. So they're in the process of cleaning it up, but the canyon is messy and snowy, and actually our next guest is caught in that. So we'll hope she gets here, and we'll hope that everyone's safe. And in the meantime, if you're heading eastbound on 80, you may want to take another moment or two in Salt Lake. So, well, let's get started with our talk of the Yeti. And Mike, why don't you talk about the origins of the Yeti, what you know about the Yeti, and then how it ended up at Ramp Sports.
Well, the origin of the Yeti itself goes way back, like you said. And I think I actually just read something recently where they think they've identified an ancient polar bear or something like that. But our Yeti's origin is about 2 years ago. We were at a show. I think it was in Minneapolis, and we had just finished like a 12-hour day of talking, and we were sitting eating, and I said, you know, we're building this new factory, and I have a goal that we don't throw away our scrap. Like, somehow I want to find a way to reuse this scrap. And we thought about doing things like making cornhole games and all kinds of ideas, and I said, well, why don't we make a giant sculpture with it, and every year do a different one, and year one, why don't we make a Yeti? And so Vanessa, who's our communications person, she's reached out to the art community, and these guys, one of them is from Mississippi. He's kind of the lead player in the Yeti Collective, picked up on the idea, and they're very successful artists. And they came here with a truckload of scrap steel that they had gotten from junkyards and showed up to do this project. And we had about four dumpsters at least full of the long strips that are cut when you clean up the sides of skis and snowboards. And that's his fur, and all this steel is the internal frame. And when they started, I mean, my vision of this thing was about a quarter of what these guys have actually done. It's impressive what these guys have done. And
Mike, did the Yeti Collective come together for this project, or was it already in existence and they picked up on the fact that they could do a Yeti for a ramp?
No, it already existed, but I think that it only recently had existed. And these guys came together, and they're coming to our art show, which is this Saturday from 3 to 10 at Ramp. And, of course, the Yeti is the star of the art show because he's easily 30-plus feet tall and very impressive. And but we have about 15 other local artists that have made sculptures, paintings, wall hangings, you name it. I mean, I saw a project the other day a guy brought in that's an exact-to-scale replica of the Wasatch Range that's all made out of scrap.
Wow.
And there's about 1,400 holes through the material, and it's all tied together with strips of ski base.
And are they using your scrap, all the artists?
Or yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Every artist that's bringing a piece to your show has used Ramp scrap?
Correct. We've had, they kept coming in and asking once the word got out, could they get pieces of bamboo, which we use for our cores or ski base. One guy made a moose head. And the antlers are made out of rolled up ski base. It's spectacular.
So wait, what is the ski base material?
It's a sintered 7,500 carbon high molecular base material, polyethylene, and it's comparable to the best bases in the world. And it comes from a company in Ohio, Crown Plastic. So we try to find everything locally that we can. There's some things like ski tops you can only get from a company in Austria if you want really good ones. But most of the materials we've been able to find from U.S. companies, which has been great.
Yeah, that is great. What other materials are out there in that heap?
There's quite a bit of bamboo. There's also base material, top material. And if people come in and talk to us, we can oftentimes find other things that are useful also. But, you know, we have a real goal to try not to throw things away. We've been making furniture out of old skis and snowboards, you know, rocking chairs and Adirondack chairs and things like that. And
how did you do with meeting your goal as far as not throwing stuff away with the Yeti, the art, and the furniture that you've been building?
We throw away very little. There's some things we can't recycle. Like, for instance, if resin gets into, like, our breather material, we can't recycle it, unfortunately. But literally, I don't know what the percent exactly is, but there's not very much that we actually have to throw away.
And then looking forward, are you going to have room for large sculptures like this? I mean, do you have to start to plan the parking lot and where on the property you can put the next, version or iteration of the Yeti? The woolly mammoth or whatever it's going to be?
Yeah. We actually have a lot of room on our lot where we are. We're over by the Home Depot right next to Triumph, and we have quite a bit of land, but I think we've actually used between parking lots and buildings, the amount that's allocated for structure. But the county gave us permission to build this piece of art, which was great. And if the county gives us permission to make more of these things, we will, because we have plenty of land for them to sit on. you know, so it just depends, I guess, on that.
Have you talked to the county, or has this thought occurred that maybe this becomes public art that gets relocated to some other place, and every year you keep it on site for a period of time, and then it gets, you know, moved out or redistributed to some location that's appropriate in the county or in Park City?
We haven't had the conversation, but I've thought about it quite a bit.
I think the historic wall out here could use a Yeti just to complete it. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking next year's would be a giant snowman, but it's totally open for debate.
Right.
But this Yeti is so big, he can't be moved. He's actually permanently fixed to the concrete platform, and he even has a 7-foot lightning rod driven into the ground just in case, because he's a very large steel internal frame. But actually, he's so well built and so well designed that his rear arm could host a rail jam and a big air contest. Because it was built that his rear arm has metal pipes on the top surface and could actually host. So we plan to do we're thinking of the name Yeti Open, but something like that, or Yeti Palooza or something, a rail jam type and big air event in the not too distant future.
So how about a little bit more about the event on the 2nd? It's at your factory out there by Home Depot in the Silver Creek Industrial Area or Business Park.
Correct. And it's going to go from Saturday from 3 in the afternoon till 10 at night. And we have three different bands that are playing. And there's local chefs that are bringing food and drink and adult and kids type drinks. And we're expecting a really big turnout. And I think it's going to be really fun because I've never been to an event myself that's an art show that also kind of focuses in on action sports and the local community and art that's been made out of scrap. I just think it'll be really fun.
And that obviously is a big part of RAMP. It's part of your acronym. RAMP is Writers, Artists, Musician Product or Project. So, you know, there it is right there, the artist as part of your DNA.
Yeah, it was really funny. Like, the name actually came from Ross Powers, who's an Olympic and X Games gold medalist. And he was actually with me Monday testing the final versions of the snowboards at A Basin over in Colorado. But he was the one that thought of the name, and he was talking to a band, one of the members of the Dave Matthews Band, who he's friends with. And there's like a lot of respect and admiration, I think. You know, the artists think it's really cool what the athletes do and vice versa. And they thought it would be really, really cool that there could be some sort of a collaboration. And it's really informal. But there's a lot of them that have been willing to throw their name onto our website in support of, you know, a company that has really best practices. So
let's talk a little bit about those best practices. I've been out to the factory and I've seen how everything is recycled and there's nothing so toxic going on out there. Everyone can breathe pretty much without masks other than dust masks, I would assume. But how does it compare to the rest of the industry? What are other ski companies doing? Are you completely revolutionary?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in some senses, yes, but part of it is we're new. Like, a company that's been around forever has a really hard time once you've already built your factory and your cost structure has been in place forever. It's hard to start adapting to the new things because it's just not in your basic DNA. So from a cost standpoint, and you've already owned all this equipment, you know, we built it from the ground up to try to be able to use, you know, practices that were really good. Like, for instance, we found a resin from a U.S. company called Entropy, and they call it SuperSap, and it actually is pine byproduct-based versus petrochemical-based. So it's not like you could take a bath in this stuff, but when you get it on your arms and when you're around it, it doesn't cause you to get a rash and things. Like, when I used to make skis for another company that used traditional resins a long time ago, I would get like a big rash of my arms from being around that type of epoxy. This stuff, you can barely even smell it. But the key thing is it has to be legitimate. Like, there's a lot of green products that are green, but they don't necessarily work as well. This stuff has superior adhesion and strength characteristics when we do breakage tests in the laboratory. So it's a legitimate product. And we also use a Forestry Stewardship Certified Bamboo Core, which is quite expensive. But, you know, this company in California called Plybu, they own the facility in Asia where it's harvested. So they use best practices from a harvesting. You know, they only cut the 5-year-old tree, so you can't even tell the mountainside has been harvested. And they use formaldehyde-free resins so that when we're cutting it, you know, the dust isn't going to cause you to get some kind of horrible side effect of resins that are full of formaldehyde.
Like, what happens 10 years out when you are conventional, traditional practices? Is RAMP going to continue to be able to adjust, or do you have to reinvent your stuff yourself, or is there another company that's going to come in and build from the ground up with a clean slate that all of a sudden becomes the progressive best practices leader? I mean, can you remain on that cutting edge, or do you, you know, just because of the nature of business, become conventional?
Well, I think it, you know, it depends on what conventional turns into. I think from a technology standpoint, we have a patent-pending invention that gives us a big advantage where we can change the width and the shape and the side cut of a ski with this new process we have without having to make a new mold. And that's a big advantage in this era because most of the changes in product come from changes in shape. So we don't have to commit to tooling that you got to stick with, for instance, for like 4 years to try to make that pay off. As side cut trends and turn radius trends change, we can just change the computer programs and do it.
Now, that in and of itself, that lack of need to create new molds for every side cut, that's how you remain competitive, right?
Yeah,
in terms of price?
Well, from a pricing standpoint, I think we are competitive somewhat because of our business model. You know, it costs a lot more. People in the U.S. get paid. In our factory, there's nobody getting paid less than $13 an hour, which is like $2,300 a month, I think. And in China, people that make skis get about $200 a month.
Mm.
So you can't make skis here as inexpensively as you can in China. But we also sell a lot of our product through our website, which means that our margin is good even while we give people good value. So from the standpoint of our business model, we have some advantages. But I mean, Tim makes a good point. You know, I think we can be competitive by having the most interesting technology, and also as long as our engineer is excellent, which our engineer is fantastic. But I think that I welcome everybody else to rise to that level of best practices. Mm-hmm. I think that right now that might seem unusual. Like, we ship people their skis and snowboards in padded ski bags instead of a box. You know, we do a lot of other things as well. And if everybody gets to that level and that becomes the new norm, that's great. But I think that we have to remain really interesting from a technology standpoint. And we can be pretty creative with our general ideas with the way we use scrap or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Another thing that makes you unique is how much you're part of this community. And you really helped pioneer the Park City Center for Advanced Professional Studies program, the PC CAPS program, that is happening for the first year at the Park City High School. So just give us a little update on that. Those kids are designing some graphics for you.
Yeah, actually, there's quite a few projects. I was on my way to a meeting in Europe, and I had been very busy with a lot of things. And I asked two of the kids that are in the business part of it if they could do some research and find me pricing for skis and snowboards in Asia. And these guys were pretty clever, I would say, because they did it. They got back to me. It was like, oh, it took a little longer than I thought because of the language issues and everything, but we did it. And so, you know, they found me those, and we have those guys also working on a project where they're going to learn a lot about sales, going to local businesses and talking about RAMP. And, you know, we've trained them on this and to present a locals deal for people who live here so they get better deals on product. But we have also engineering projects that are going on with Charlie, the teacher who's the engineering teacher. And those kids have been over for tours, and I think they're going to work on some skateboard projects for our new longboards. And Polly has a group that are working on putting together a graphic portfolio so people could choose graphics for custom graphics. And then there's another woman who used to be a manager at General Electric at a very high level, ran factories and things for them. And she's going to have the kids come and do a study to make sure that we're following all the best safety practices, and another study to see if we're following all the best, like, EPA-type practices. So the kids are, you know, I think they're getting some good experiences. I know I would have liked to have had those kind of experiences.
Oh, yeah, it's real-world stuff. So that's great you're a participant in that, a big participant. So November 2nd, this Saturday, from 3 to 10, it's a big party out at RAMP Sports in the industrial park there by Home Depot and Triumph. And
we're easy to find now with the Yeti out front.
Just look for the Yeti.
Especially when it's dark. You see these two huge glowing in the dark blue eyes that are made out of High West Distillery whiskey bottles.
Oh, nice.
Very nice. Okay, bands, food, it'll be inside and out. And can people, are you going to be giving tours? It's such a great tour.
Yeah, yeah, there'll be opportunities to come inside and look at how we're doing things. We'll have to try to make sure we're molding a pair of skis that day or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, we welcome everyone, and I think it'll be a fun time.
How about your discounted skis? You're going to have some of those around, some of those C-grade skis or B-grade skis?
We've been powering through them, but we have a few. We probably have at least 20 pair left, I would say. So, we've been, you know, we get some factory seconds. I'm happy to say that's becoming a more rare thing as the factory's now just starting its second season. But the great thing about them is we sell them for, I think we're selling them for $299 for even an expert like powder ski. And the only thing that might be wrong is a slight like discoloration of a die cut letter or something. Like we use them for magazine test skis, demo skis, that kind of stuff.
So not only come and enjoy the party, but bring your checkbook because you might be able to pick up some great skis.
Right.
Yeah. We always try to treat locals really good, whether it's on something like that as an opportunity and also just as a general locals offer that we have through our website.
I've taken advantage of that.
I know. I've seen you out there on them.
Yep.
Very good. All right, Mike Kilchenstein, thanks so much for coming in today. And Mike's the owner, founder, president of Ramp Sports. And we hope to see you on Saturday for that unveiling of the Yeti and about 15 other works as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of art that's collecting there at Ramp right now. I can't wait for everybody to see it.
Oh, sounds like fun. All right, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Lynn.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Josh Hanegarney. He's, of course, the world's strongest librarian.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from checking and savings accounts to business lending. We have Heber Valley Bank in Midway and Heber, and Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with Tim Henney. Well, Josh Hanegarney is the world's strongest librarian. He works at the Salt Lake City Public Library, and he wrote a book about being a librarian with Tourette's. We interviewed Josh last May, right when his book came out, but since then his book has been selling like crazy. And he's been speaking around everywhere around the nation. And we thought we'd air that interview again. We may not be able to air it in its entirety because our third guest, Cindy McGill, dream interpreter, is on her way here, unfortunately detained in the accident on I-80 right now, which, to remind our listeners, it's on eastbound I-80. It's right below Lamb's Canyon. The traffic was backed up below the mouth of the canyon, and they're in the process of cleaning that up, but it's very messy, so take care as you come up the canyon. Here's Josh. We spoke with him again in May, and we're airing that interview right now. Well, our next guest, Josh Hanegarney, believes in curiosity, questions, strength, and that things are never so bad that they can improve. And he ought to know about overcoming challenges. He was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome as a child. He has long struggled with the tics that Tourette's produces, uncontrollable and unstoppable urges that manifest in various ways. You might say that Josh has embraced the challenge really in the biggest of ways. While Josh and many Tourette's often have those audible tics, which lead to loud outbursts of noises, Josh has chosen to work in a very quiet place, a library. In fact, the Salt Lake Library. We're lucky to be joined in the studio today by Josh Hanegarney. He's on a book tour. His new book, The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. And Josh Hanegarney, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, Josh, it's really delightful to have you here. And I wanted to ask you if you would define for us really, well, give us your definition of Tourette syndrome.
Well, you'll hear a lot of different things in the media, and I understand, because what we could call Hollywood Tourette's definitely makes for the best joke. It's the uncontrollable yelling of obscenities, and you get a lot of good comic mileage out of that. It can affect people in a lot of different ways, but at the core, it's only two things. It's involuntary noises or involuntary movements. So either sounds you'd rather not make or movements you don't want to make. Now, within those two ranges, that can look and sound like a lot of different things. And I'm a great example of that. I mean, a year ago, I was speaking at a camp in Gettysburg, at a camp for kids with Tourette's. And you'd have everything from little boys blinking their eyes too much to people like me where I have tics where my teeth break and my thumb dislocates and I get hernias from the screaming to guys even worse than me. And it's very weird to think that this all comes from the same weird genetic place somehow with this array of symptoms. But that's pretty much the least you need to know. Noises and sounds that you'd prefer not to make.
So really it's a neurological thing. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, the race is on for the gene or the genes that cause it. But yeah, I mean, as far as I know, it's genetics and chemicals.
And it's different from a lot of things that we've talked about recently on this show, Asperger's, autism. There's no cognitive element here. So this is all physical.
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Some of the disabling aspects of it are very much mental. Because if you choose to go out in public, you risk judgment and exposure. I had someone on a panel recently said, she's a professor named Angela Smith at the U, and she said sometimes you can define a disability by a disruption in the experience of the, quote, normal person. And sometimes I feel like that's how it is with Tourette's, particularly when I see kids who just have a hard time being out at a point where other people's approval is so important to them. I mean, some of it's physical, some of it's not. All of it is mental in some way, you know, in terms of just whether you feel like you can face it or not.
Yeah, it seems like it would become an emotional thing. I mean, as Tim said, we talk about autism and Asperger's, and that's very cognitive. But I would imagine that as you go along in life with these uncontrollable tics, that, yeah, the embarrassment, the frustration, all those emotional components must turn you into sort of another person until you learn how to lift weights, for example.
Well, there's been a misconception that the weights somehow helped with the tics. They actually make the tics worse most of the time. But it makes everything else feel a little more livable and tolerable because I speak all over the country at a lot of different things. And when I speak to these big groups of kids with disabilities, the ones who seem to be doing the best and thriving, they've got something in their life they're always getting better at. But more than that, they can actually measure it. So for me, I'm either stronger today than yesterday or I'm not. It's not abstract. It's a number. And it's hard not to feel more confident when you can demonstrate that you're always getting better at something. Does that make you confident? You know, I don't know. More confident, generally speaking, I believe that to be the case.
Josh, your tics, I mean, I'm looking at you here, you're a big guy, and I'm thinking, you know, back in your childhood, here's this kid growing up with all the other kids, and you've got these tics, and that probably impacted you tremendously, and as you say, had a community and societal impact that reflected back on you. But then all of a sudden, you go from being this little kid with tics to this really big guy. And how did that shift things? I mean, instead of the bullies picking on the kid with the tics, it might have been the bullies were looking out for the guy they used to pick on with the tics.
I don't know about that. And I don't want to give the impression that I got bullied more than other kids. I mean, my tics generally manifest if I'm feeling insecure or stressed out or worried, whatever. I mean, I don't have mental issues that other kids don't have. And I think most kids get picked on in some way. I had friends. I had a family where I felt safe. I had people that would stick up for me. So I don't think I was particularly tormented in school. Now, as far as the question of my size, I look now, until I was about 25, I looked like a giant toddler. I was extremely skinny, and my head, I swear my head in third grade was about the size it is now. Just could not have been less imposing, just tall and scrawny. Now, when people tell, I mean, I was speaking up at the U a couple months ago in I think it was a gender theory class, and someone said, "Do you think the discussion about Tourette's has changed because you're so intimidating?" And I said, "I don't think I'm intimidating at all. I'm not scared of confrontations, but I don't like them. I don't like to fight, but I'm decent at it." I mean, I don't understand why that even has to enter into the discussion. And I have also found that if I go out with friends, if somebody is just determined to start trouble, I'm often the one they'll start it with. I mean, do you guys ever read of Mice and Men?
Mm-hmm.
Like Curly, the nasty little guy who Lenny's very existence simply because he was big was this terrible insult. I do get some of that as well. I mean, the Tourette's makes it a little harder to ignore me. And that might be what amplifies the height and the size situation. Right. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So how about the Tourette's and how it affected you when you came? I mean, was there a point where you were like, something's going on here. I'm different than these other kids? Or did you know all along? Kind of describe how your tics have impacted you and when they started to impact you.
I was 6 years old on stage at a first grade Thanksgiving play when my parents said they first saw tics. I don't remember this. Just some eye blinking, and they said I was curling my lips and kind of craning my head around. And honestly, after that, I was aware of it sometimes, but my parents didn't bring it up again. Once they realized it didn't seem to really be on my mind, they wouldn't make an issue of it until I brought it to them. And that was finally in ninth grade when I was things were becoming much more vocal, and I was on our basketball team, and we were playing in an away game that came down to me shooting free throw after free throw after free throw down the stretch. And I remember being on the free throw line and the crowd chanting, "Twitch, twitch, twitch." And I was so furious and I wanted to win so bad, but I also had these tears in my eyes in the middle of this game. And that was when after that game ended, I told my parents, I want to go see a doctor. I got to know if this is something real. And they said, of course, let's go. But it wasn't until I brought that up that, the question had kind of forced itself on us, so then we went and got an answer.
And how did that answer affect you? I mean, I want to go find out if this is something real. You know, did you get an answer to that question?
Yes, for the time being. It feels so strange to have tics and to not have control, even though like I still feel like I should have more control than I do. Like, why can't I stop making this noise? Why can't I stop hitting myself or whatever it is? But at that point, it was still just kind of a hassle. It wasn't damaging me. And so it was enough to know, okay, I've got a thing and the thing is name. I'm not just acting out. It's not a behavior issue. I always felt like if I could at least explain myself, I feel like I'd have some more solace and it would at least give me a chance to say to people, no, here's what it is. And that is kind of what I got out of it for the time being.
And you say it's kind of situational. So are there times when you're completely relaxed and you have your tic free?
Yes. I mean, you're probably both noticing that while we talk, I don't have very many tics. Same thing happens when I'm playing the guitar. Same thing happens if I can get absorbed in my writing, which is why I'm already pretty deep into the next book. Same thing happens if I read and can get absorbed. So you just never know. But at times, there was a stretch where every time I sat down to write and suddenly I had a contract and deadlines, the tick became my fingers would start wanting to hit the keyboard. Like suddenly I needed to write and I just couldn't. It seems to just make itself as invasive and obnoxious as possible at times, given the situation I'm in.
So I wanted to ask you about that Hollywood version of Tourette's. I did go to – my first experience with Tourette's was when I was in college and there was a young lady on campus who did have that yelling obscenities tic. And do you have any idea where that comes from? Or, I mean, is it any different? Why is it obscenities? Why isn't it just a certain word?
You know, I sure don't. I've always been grateful that for me, the vocal stuff never turned into words. As to why, I just don't know. I mean, it sounds stranger because it's so socially unacceptable. But when you look at the array of tics I have, I mean, is me going Z or Durr really stranger than me yelling the F word or something? I mean, they're all just noises. Yeah. But again, I don't know how useful my speculation would be. I know that the urges, as these people with coprolalia, as that condition is called, they seem to feel the same as my urges and the little kid who blinks his eyes too much. I mean, when I was speaking at Gettysburg, this was the first time I'd encountered that. And this was actually a man that Oliver Sacks had studied. A guy named Andrew, he stood up during my talk, and it was because I was tall. He yelled, "Chop off his effing legs!" And then, like, if a woman walked by, it would change to something particularly insulting to women. If a black man walked by, same thing. And it was heartbreaking because this guy was smart, and you could see it in his eyes. He knew He was trying not to, and he was trapped in there. So
you have full awareness that you're doing it when you're doing it. You just can't stop it.
You can sometimes. I mean, like even Andrew, that guy told me, if I get on an airplane, I can't do this for 8 hours. But when I get off the plane, I mean, the pipe blows. I'm just done for a day or two as it just comes out in this explosion. I mean, I can stop it, but there's a cost for doing so.
Now, I have a couple young friends who have been diagnosed with Tourette's, and one of them, upon the diagnosis, underwent this big nutritional program. What do you do nutrition-wise that helps?
You know, most of my eating is just tied into my lifting. I want to be able to perform, and so I eat when I'm hungry. And I'm generally hungry because of the way I lift. That's the whole story as far as me. I've tried all the nutritional things that I believe you try, and none of it ever seemed particularly useful to me. You can find a lot of people with a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Josh, I know that Tourette's is a syndrome that was kind of recently diagnosed, or it doesn't have a long history.
I think it's a couple hundred years old.
Is it?
I mean, it's named,
oh, that's because
it's named
of
after
doctor,
a French guy.
Yeah, the French guy, Tourette's. Yeah. Well, okay. So we have a good period of time to look at and to do research. Is there more Tourette's today than there was 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Are we diagnosing it differently? Is there any environmental tie to say that, you know, this syndrome is more prevalent today than it was?
I'm not sure. I'll say this. Every time a new edition of the DSM comes out, it's like 600 pages longer than the previous one. So by the time DSM-6 comes out, I fully expect that both of you will have diagnosable Tourette's too, like any little fidget or anything. You know, as the criteria change to what is classifiable as Tourette's, I believe you could probably make the case for there being more than there ever has been. That might just be that certain things, you know, according to how we categorize it, have changed.
All right. So, Josh, we want to move into your very fascinating life, which has to do with the fact that you went into the Salt Lake Library to find a job, which is very curious. And it really shows how you as a person, you know, tackles a challenge, an almost insurmountable challenge. But it has to do with your love of books. And what else about it attracted you?
Well, personally, the library is everything I care about. Those are my sacred places. When I finally finished my English degree after 10 years of pecking away at it, I realized an English degree is not good for anything but more school. And the library school recruiters just happened to be there, you know, shortly after I had started, and they sold me. They were very, very honey-tongued. You probably would have signed up as well. You know, it's kind of a dumb way to approach a problem. A lot of what people tend to call courage in me just feels like spite and stubbornness to me because I don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted was somewhere that would force me to deal with it minute to minute where I'd be terribly exposed. So when I'm there, I have to figure out how to make this minute as livable for myself and the other patrons as possible so that the next minute will be better so that I can get through a shift without ruining my day and everyone else's. And it forces me to ask questions. So that's kind of like the library metaphor at the bottom of it. It forces me to keep examining it and trying things. Otherwise, I won't be able to be there doing my job. If I gave myself a pass to lie on the couch, I would not be asking those questions because no one would hear me and I'd feel relatively safe. And I don't want to feel safe. I want to feel interested and I want to feel curious. And if you don't get those things out of being at the library, you're using the library wrong.
Now, on the cover of your book, The World's Strongest Librarian, there is, in fact, a very strong-looking person with this huge stack of books. It's a great cover. And so how did you get – I'm so surprised when you just said that the weightlifting actually can make the tics worse. I would think you went into weightlifting because it's some way to blow off that steam of those uncontrollable urges.
Well, originally, my dad talked me into going to the gym just to put some weight back on because I was convulsing so badly at the time. I just couldn't keep much food down. So I weigh about 260 right now. And when this was happening, I weighed about 160. And I was this tall. I mean, I'm 6'7". It was a bad time. And my dad said, I think that you're in a situation you can't control. I have some experience with this, and all you can do is introduce something into it that you can control. Maybe this won't help, but maybe we can at least put the weight back on. And that's kind of where it started. I was surprised to find that even though I was weak as a kitten and my workouts weren't going to impress anyone, it was the only time every day where I felt like I had some control of my body, where I was making it do something instead of it making me do something. These days, it does help sometimes, but it's tied into some ideas I have about breathing. So if I go in and lift and I get all freaked out and purple-faced and just grind away, my breathing gets out of control. That is inevitably when the tics get as bad as they can get. So you'd probably be surprised to see me work out because my goal is usually to look bored and never get out of breath. You can still do this and get stronger, but I'm very much outside of the no pain, no gain crowd, which is why I'm never going to be as big as those guys. But if I tried to do that, my tics, I'd never get the better of it.
Mm-hmm. Josh, by putting yourself in that environment in the library where you have to deal with your tics minute to minute and get through an hour and then a day and then a week, how has that played out and helped you in other aspects of your life, or has it?
I think it has. I think if I have a friend named Frankie Ferris who always says there's no off switch to adaptation, meaning you're always getting better at whatever it is you do. That can be a reward or a punishment, depending on the patterns you're in and the habits you have. I'm at the library and I'm forced to ask and answer questions all day. And so I like to think that that is in turn, it is making me better at asking questions and learning. And what's the downside to that? How could that not creep into everything else in your life?
Right. And that's a lesson for anybody to kind of challenge yourself instead of, as you said, lay on the couch and you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have written a book. You wouldn't be on a tour. You wouldn't be giving an interview. So you've challenged yourself to become more of a person. When you went to the library and you talked to people and you forced yourself to confront this process, are you confronting your fears or are you trying to challenge yourself to be a better person, or do you see those two as the same?
You know, I kind of feel like I'm just a competitive idiot and I can't stand. I mean, I kind of pretend it's this other thing working against me. And of course, Tourette's has no idea I exist. It's just chemicals and genes. But if I was at home, I'd feel like I'd be beaten by something. Now, when people tell me this is so inspiring, I don't tell people what to be inspired by, but you're not going to hear me say, you know who's inspiring? Me. Because I still feel like I'm in the thick of it, and I do it because I can't stand the thought of not doing it, of losing. So nobody else really factors into it in that way. And again, I don't know if that's the best way to approach a problem, but I don't know what else to do.
Did your tics limit your curiosity in any way?
I don't know about that, although I'm always when it's bad, I got to do whatever helps. And if that means I play the guitar or I play a video game or whatever, those are times when I'm not asking questions or being aggressively curious.
But you're exploring other aspects of being a person. So maybe the tics actually drove you in ways, like drove you to the library and drove you to write the book.
Maybe. I'd like that. Yeah. I hope that's true.
Josh, any scientific advances that are of note with Tourette's? Anything helping the situation?
I am hearing a lot lately about something called behavior reversal therapy. I believe it is. And it actually sounds a lot like some of the things Adam would help me come to intuitively that we were just calling by different names. I know plenty of people who are having great results with medication. I know lots of people who have good results with physical activity. Most cases aren't even nearly as bad as mine are. Mm-hmm. So it's a good question, but I admit I kind of fell out of love with keeping up with all the research until my son started having things. So I don't see anything to get too excited about, but there are always people working on it.
So you're not on medication?
No, I haven't taken anything for about 8 years, and I took everything that you possibly try, but there's really no Tourette's drug. None of it helped. All of it had bad side effects.
One quick question about the breathing. Do you do yoga or meditation, breathing?
I've tried, and that kind of comes back to the circumstantial thing. If I know the goal is to sit still and quietly, I can do anything but.
Okay, That makes sense. The book is The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. And Josh Hanegarney, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And if any of you are hearing this, send me a reading recommendation anywhere you can find me.
Very good.
Where can people find Josh?
The blog is called World's Strongest Librarian, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook. Both are just Josh Hanegarney. I'd love to hear from you, specifically about books. And if any of you Tourette's people are listening to this, I expect you to write to me and tell me about yourself.
Very good. Josh, thanks so much. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, our next guest, Cindy McGill, couldn't have dreamed that she would be stuck in traffic on I-80 on one of two accidents out there right now. Be careful, everyone. It's on eastbound I-80. And Cindy McGill, welcome to you. We'll just get right into this interview.
Thank you.
Good morning. Well, you are a dream interpreter. You make a living doing this around the world at events like the Olympics, Sundance Film Festival, even Burning Man. And you were featured in Dreams, a documentary which chronicles live dream interpretation encounters that took place actually here at the Sundance Film Festival. And you also spoke last night at Healthy, Happy Human Beings. And we don't have a lot of time with you now, and I'm sorry you're stuck in traffic there, but let's hear a little recap of what you gave last night for those of us who missed it.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's just an incredible journey in the journey of dreams. They're messages that we receive in the night when we're sleeping, when we're resting, when we're able to just kind of calm down, you know, and oftentimes they're direction for our life, they're warnings for our life, they give us understanding about our daily life or what's going on in our life. So it's really been an incredible journey for us. We've been all over the world interpreting dreams and at all the different festivals and places that you mentioned and others, and we found out that dreams are universal and inexhaustible. You're never going to ever exhaust the topic of dreams. Everyone is different. Every person is made different. And so the messages we receive will be specific for us, the way we're designed, the way we listen, the way that we're put together, and what our destiny is.
Cindy, do the dreams have a message that is a true message? And is the dream open to interpretation, which is what changes it? Or is there something, you know, coming from the dream itself? Because it sounds to me like you could take a dream and interpret it in a number of ways and fit it into whatever your personal perspective is. But that may not that may not be the purpose of a dream. It may have a specific message.
Right. Yeah, we've known it all throughout history. Dreams have been real important in the direction for many different things, invention dreams, direction dreams, warning dreams. We went through in the book, we began by talking about the different inventions that were created from a dream. So those messages are definitely something to pay attention to. And then other ones were warning dreams, like the Titanic. People decided not to get on the boat as a result of having a dream that it wasn't safe. So, we documented a lot of those different dreams. Not all dreams have a specific meaning. However, they can be messages for our life just in helping us individually to go forward or maybe even, just unlock. It would be like having a conversation with someone and having you bounce off information to someone else. They're going to see something that you don't see.
Okay.
So, it really helps us to get another perspective or another understanding, because you're right. We can make a dream say anything we want it to say, but it's helpful to have an outsider.
You're not really looking at the neuroscience aspect of dreaming, because we've heard recently that dreams, have a purpose, which is your brain is processing the events of the day and the possible events of tomorrow and sort of sorting through all this data that's come at it over a period of time. But that's not really what you're talking about. You're talking about a specific message from the universe, per se, to us.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's very clear. I mean, there are messages that are being communicated to us. There's so many things that we don't see in our waking hours. There's things that are going on all around us that we're just not privy to. We just don't understand. So in a dream, I believe in God, and I believe God can give dreams to people because he made us all. And so that's where I take it from, is a spiritual perspective and an understanding. That's just my personal journey. But I believe that there are dreams that will give us direction, that will give us understanding about certain things. I've run into so many people all around the world who were being given a specific message for a destiny for their own life, and yet they didn't recognize it because they didn't understand that it was something specific for them, for them participating with, partnering with the dream that in the message of the dream, and then making a difference in their future.
That's curious. How did they then recall the dream later? Did you help them to bring it up later? Because we usually forget what our dreams are if we don't actively, consciously recall them within the next 24 hours or so.
Yeah, a lot of people actually journal their dreams, and so they remember them. And they can recite, they can actually bring to mind the ones that were the most specific, the ones that were most impacting. When a dream has a message that needs to be acted on, it won't leave you alone. It's like you can't forget it. It's one of those, kinds of messages that just sticks with you. And we found, even in the documentary, the last guy that we interpreted a dream for had a dream 30 years ago. He didn't have the same dream for 30 years. He just had one dream 30 years ago. And when we encountered him, he rehearsed that dream to us as if he'd had it the night before. That's how fresh in his mind it was. And so when he told us the dream, immediately I saw it like a puzzle coming together. And I was able to make understanding of that particular message, and I delivered it to him. And it was actually playing out in his life at the time that I encountered him.
Cindy, one quick question. We're kind of running out of time, but it's obvious.
Sure.
That the obvious question for me is, if there are these specific messages coming to people and even non-specific messages, where are they coming from? Who is the sender of the message?
There's three sources that I've identified. One is the spirit of a lie, something that was told to us all along through our lives that just wasn't true about us. There's the spirit of truth, the one that is truthful for us, the one that would give us a message the way we're designed for our purpose in life. And then us, we will talk to us. Our subconscious or our conscious mind will talk with us, and we reason things out. So when you were talking about dreams of activity in the day, yes, those are very vivid dreams, and they do speak to us. So we have to identify where is this coming from. And then what do we do with the message that's being given to us?
Very interesting.
So in the book, I made it really simple for people to be able to unlock their dreams, to restart their dreams, to understand what dreams could be meaning. It's just a simple guide to launch people into possibly paying more attention to their dreams and understanding there could be messages there to guide us through our journey in life.
Our guest is Cindy McGill, and her book is What Your Dreams Are Telling You, Unlocking Solutions While You Sleep. And it's a pretty fascinating topic. So thanks for joining us, and sorry that you got hung up on I-80 there, but we appreciate your time.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Welcome to winter, too.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, and our teams will be out actually at the Sundance Film Festival this year. So look for us. We'll be all around
Interpreting
dreams for people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll look forward to that. Thank you, Cindy.
Thanks.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch.
Our underwriters today, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, San Francisco Design, Utah Prudential Real Estate, and the Park City Clinic.
And join us tomorrow for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City. Be careful, everyone out there. Slick roads.